All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. As promised, we're shifting our focus again to the energy sector. I know a lot of our listeners keep responding to us that they do like this energy content that we are bringing on with a couple of our regular guests in the back half of this show. It's with Joseph Schachter, founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report, also editor of the Eye on Energy Report. That's a free offering from Joseph that recaps more the fundamental data for the oil and natural gas markets. Also, to note, Joseph's conference, the Catch the Energy Conference in Calgary, happening again in October this year, October 19th. Joseph has sent us a special code for all of you, our listeners, to sign up for some free tickets and also to sign up for a subscription, whether quarterly or for the whole year, to the Schachter Report. I hope you do sign up for that, especially all of you who are focused and investing in the energy sector. Joseph, let's start off with a broad overview on what's happening in the oil and natural gas sectors. First, oil. Look, oil has been fading in price. It's now in the low 70s, still very much range bound, but this recent downward action just over the last about week and a half has broken some of the at least short-term lower levels, but we can go the whole way back really to the beginning of the year when this is around the price that oil entered the year. Joseph, what's going on here? What's pushing around this oil price? How much lower do you think it could go?
Well, the premium for oil, because of the concern about the war potential with Iran, we rallied at the end of July from 71.67 to 80.16. So, you know, a big bump over $8 there on the war premium. And there was a war premium before that because, of course, the, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah and everything else. We've come down from that 80.16. Today we're 71.60. And I still have, and I've been saying for months, and I, you know, last time we talked, we were $77 or so, that we were going to break 70 and potentially go down to the 66 to 69 level per barrel. And that would probably give us a very strong and important bottom. And the stocks would correct another 5, 10%, and we'd get some quite attractive bargains. And I still believe that is the case. And I think sometime in September, we'll be sending out action alert buys with some new additional buys, plus reiterating buys on names that are currently on the list. And the reason for that is demand in the two biggest markets is weak. China, of course, there's been lots of reports about diesel demand falling sharply, imports of oil going down by China, lots of problems in the manufacturing area. Consumers aren't spending, buying as much EVs or, you know, or buying cars. And so there's the lack of demand mainly from diesel, but overall refinery are seeing lower demand. And then you've got the United States, where demand is down this week, 101,000 barrels from last week, and overall demand is flat with last year, but gasoline demand is down by 0.8% from a year ago. So the data is clearly coming out that there's weakness in consumption in the two biggest consuming nations, you know, 20 million in the States, 15 million in China. And if you don't have growth there, then the assumptions that OPEC had that there would be 2 million barrels of growth this year, they may not even be 500,000 or 600,000. And if that's the case, inventories are going to build. And once we get through the summer driving season, so September, October into November, and if we start seeing builds, today we saw a draw, but a lot of it was related to a pickup in exports. But if we do see buildups, you know, starting in September after Labor Day travel holiday is over, that I think is going to bring the price down. And if the stocks correct another 5 or 10%, we're going to get some tremendous buys, and we'll be sending out buy lists. One thing we are doing is we're going over all the quarterly reports that have come out, and we're having our quarterly webinar, another reason for people to consider subscribing. And we're going to have that quarterly webinar next Thursday. It is a 90-minute session on the, you know, on the 29th of August, Thursday from 7 to 8:30. And we do two Q&A sessions along the way, plus my presentation. So we have a lot going on now. And So the report that you'll see this Thursday is going to include 23 companies, the biggest report I've ever done, just over, you know, reviewing their Q2s. So that would be in the hands of subscribers before the webinar next Thursday.
I appreciate you mentioning that call, Joseph. And yeah, that's a lot of companies, 23 companies to go over, diving into the Q2 financials. Good opportunity for people to get on the stick here, get a subscription and check out that call. You brought up the fact that you're looking for this buying opportunity as oil prices continue to pull back and the demand side is weaker. But you mentioned the only draw we saw was because of exports. Well, speaking of exports, that makes us think of natural gas. And we're getting close to these LNG terminals coming on where there's going to be more export capacity in both Canada and the U.S. How are you looking at natural gas pricing? How are you looking at the market for natural gas? People are always wondering, Joseph, are we going to see $3 again? Are we going to see $4 again? Or are we going to be stuck in the twos?
Well, U.S. is $2.15 U.S., and today AECO, I think, is 70 cents Canadian, which are lousy prices. Nobody makes any money at that rate, but it's mostly a byproduct of the liquids-rich Montney in Canada and of the liquids-rich Permian in the States. So you want to produce the oil, and you know, if you don't get much for the natural gas, you really don't care. But once the two more LNG plants come on in the States and one in Canada, LNG Canada, the, you know, phase one, train one, that's going to help. We know that we have Cedars approved with the Haisla Nation, and Pembina's working with them. And it's majority owned by the Haisla Nation, I think 50.1% and 49.9% for Pembina. That project is moving forward 2028. We have two or three other projects that are moving forward, Rockies LNG being one of them, one backed by Enbridge, which of course has the financial power to do it. So we're going to be seeing 6 to 7 BCF by the end of the decade. We're producing about 17 BCF. So just LNG Canada is 2.1. So 2.1 on 17, you know, that's, you know, 11, 12% additional volumes that are going to go to the west that aren't going to go to the east and the south. And that'll tighten things up in Canada. And that's why you can sell gas for all of 2025 at over $3 Canadian, because everybody assumes everything's going to tighten up. And you're seeing companies hedge to make sure that they're okay, you know, given the current pricing, which is pretty horrible.
Joseph, is there a risk here that when these terminals come online and that demand side picks up, even though we still have production, fairly solid production at these lower price levels, that let's say price moves up a dollar, that supply could drastically increase as well? And maybe the upward pricing moves in natural gas, while they're there, could be a bit muted?
Well, the question is, a dry gas is not really an attractive. There's a lot of shut-in dry gas. So if you get to $3, you'll probably see that come on. But the key thing is where is it going to go, the takeaway? So if it's dry gas in northeast BC or right on the Alberta-BC border, then it can go west into the pipelines. If it's stuck in lower central Alberta or Saskatchewan, then I'm not sure you're going to see it come on stream until prices become very attractive and you can sell it, not just for, you know, a blip during the wintertime, because you don't want to spend a lot of money developing and putting in the infrastructure, compression, all those things, if you don't see a sustainable price for some length of time to justify the capital expenditures. So a glut coming, I don't see in the near term. If we get very high prices and the LNG terminals are desperate for gas and they buy it and tighten the inventory situation in Canada and in the States for the U.S. Designations and for the LNG plants there, they're going to double the LNG capacity in the States between now and the end of the decade. And I think, 7-8 years ago, they had no industry. So they've come from nothing in 7 or 8 years to be the largest LNG producer in the world. And it's needed because the growth rate in China, South Korea, India, all these countries are going to want to switch from coal-fired. Nuclear is not really getting that much support. I saw China was going to add 2 more nuclear plants, but they're slowing down building coal-fired. India's planning to slow down coal-fired. And the interim fuel that everybody wants to go to is natural gas because it's less environmentally a problem.
Well, Joseph, when you're looking at the companies that are exposed to natural gas, either as a forward producer or maybe as a contributing co-credit, how important is the difference between the dry gas but also the natural gas liquids? We don't spend as much time talking about producers that have natural gas liquids, but a lot of times they have more of that than the dry gas if they're an oil producer. How do you balance that out when you're evaluating these companies?
Well, you want companies that are producing 20 to 30% liquids because that's over half your revenues then. And those companies, even with, you know, $72 or less WTI, they're still doing well. But to really see both engines moving, you're going to need to see 250 plus Canadian AECO. You're going to need to see, you know, oil prices north of 80. And then the industry is going to have to make the decision, do we, you know, produce the same volumes unless we can contract more to the LNG plants? And do we, you know, pay down debt if that's still an issue? And then how much do we do for shareholder returns? And companies have been arm twisted by the street for shareholder returns, both NCIBs and, you know, special dividends and dividends. So we're going to probably see the shareholder return argument staying in place, which means companies can't be stupid and overinvest and bring on too much production, because shareholders are on top of them now saying, we need a return along the way. You're not here for growth. You're here to make money for us.
All right, Joseph, let's move into the energy stocks then. I want to talk from a high level, starting simply looking at XLE, that ETF that follows the energy sector and shares. That's down about 10% from the April high. Oil is down about 16%. Natural gas is actually up a bit from April, but well off of some of those spike highs we saw in May and early June. It seems interesting to me that the energy stocks almost seem to be holding up better than oil, but again, they're balanced with natural gas, even in this more flat, almost boring environment. Broadly, how are you looking at these stocks? I know you're waiting for buy signals, but the stocks do seem to be holding up fairly well.
Yeah, I think, as you mentioned, the XLE was at 98.97 at the high. The low for the 52-week low was 78.9. It's 88.58 today. I think it could go down to the low 80s if we see a break of $70 WTI. I think that seems to be a magic number that really has a downside pressure on the oil stocks historically, because the margins get cut severely. You know, you take $10 off the price of oil and you get to, and your break-even cost, let's say, is all in the 50s. Well, if you're getting 80s plus the exchange rate, that's a big number. On the other hand, if the price comes down and the exchange rate is not so generous, then, you know, I think we're going to be seeing the TXX today, energy index is 284, and the high was 308. I think it could go below 240 over the next month, and that would be the thing that drives some very, very attractive buy levels. And one thing I've talked with you before, which is the energy bullish percentage index. And historically, when the market's very buoyant, it trades in the 80-90% range. And when you were talking about April, when we had the high for the year, it was trading at 91%. So 91% of investors were bullish on the price of oil. If you go back to early August, when we had that pullback, we were down to 23%. And the number from last night's close was 31.8. I think we're going to go down below 10%. And we have had 10% below before. If you go to March of 2020, we were down at 3.7%. If you go to March of 2023, we were down at 8.7%. September 2022, we were 4.8%. So anytime you get down below 10%, it's a buy. Anytime you get below 5%, it's a table pounding buy. And we're, given where we are now and the price of oil going down, and if it gets below 70, I think we're going to see at least a buy signal. But we may, if we get below 5%, have a table pounding buy signal, which is one of the, it's an infrequent signal, but it usually is a very, very reliable signal. And the upsides usually from there can be multiples, you know, when you get the rally phase thereafter.
Well, we'll be looking for that table pounding buy signal for sure, Joseph. But when you look at the range of companies in the oil space, the smaller producers and some of the developers, they got hit a lot harder. So when you look at XLE, they've held up better, the bigger producers. But when you look at XOP, it's a little bit different story. I mean, the April high was 162 and it just dove down to 127. So a lot bigger percentage move down, a lot more volatility in the smaller to mid cap companies. Do you think that there could be bigger returns to the upside if people positioned in some of the admittedly riskier, but a higher torque small and mid cap companies?
Yeah, if the smaller companies have a good mix of oil, like, you know, let's say 40 to 60%, which means that bulk of their revenues are coming from the oil side, but have some natural gas, so you have the torque when that kicks in, and have good balance sheets, and debt to cash flow is under 1x debt to cash flow, and are trading under 2x cash flow, that usually is a bargain territory. And I see some names that are there now. And if I'm right about the pullback, we're going to get even more names. And that's why I think we have a good list of action on our buy list right now. I think I'm going to probably add 6 to 8 more names to our buy list sometime in the next few weeks if we do get that buy signal. And if we get the table pounding buy signal, I think almost, you know, the majority of names that I cover will end up being on the buy list.
The fact of the matter, too, Joseph, is that these companies, the oil companies especially, are still pumping out pretty good earnings. We've had a lot of earnings releases in the last few weeks. Anything stand out to you in terms of the overall sustainability of these companies and maybe why some of those majors are holding up better if they are generating decent profits? Give us an earnings recap, please.
Yeah, well, the larger cap companies, number one, are a lot of the oil sands producers. So they have stable production or slight growth because of SAGD and, you know, tweaking the capability of the facilities. And of course, prices have been pretty high. So you've had them be the darlings of the street. But historically, they're high beta. So if the price of oil goes down below 70, I think those stocks are the ones that are the most vulnerable. And the smaller ones that have already been beaten up and are down significantly from their highs, they're the ones that probably will not see much more downside, but they're all going to be able to be, so, and they're going to be small and medium-sized companies where you're going to want to be a buyer. And in the meantime, many of these companies have very strong balance sheets and have, you know, significant, you know, dividend paying capability. I'll just give you, you know, a couple examples of some of the dividends that are out there that I believe are secure. And so investors should be doing their homework on which names fit their appetite based on the size of their investment and the focus of their investment portfolios. Are they large cap dividend yielders? Are they conservative or whatever? But I can give you a few examples. Whitecap has a 7% dividend yield right now. Companies like Paramount, 6.3% dividend yield. If you like royalty trusts, freehold royalty, pays $1.08, 9 cents a month, 7.9% yield. Pinecliff, 6.4% dividend yield. You've got Surgenery, which is 7.6% dividend yield. Hemisphere, 5.7% dividend yield. Petrus Resources, 8.9%. InPlay, 8.2%. So these companies are going to be able to continue to pay those dividends. And if we are right, that we're going to see $90 oil during winter 2024-25. And if I'm right that we go into $100 oil after 2026 thereafter and higher on the price of oil because of the demand growth, you know, that we're going to see as China recovers, U.S. starts coming back, and all of the countries where new capacity is going to come on with all of the products that are going to be needed for the climate change, renewable world, you know, nickel, copper, lithium, all those things that are going to come from South America, Asia, Africa. They're going to need a lot of fossil fuels to build out the mines. The people who work there are going to want a higher quality of life, electricity, cars, all the rest of it, better standard of living in their food. All of that is going to cause an increase in the demand for energy. And I'm in the camp that, you know, we got up to 147 in summer of 2008. I believe before the end of the decade, we will see all-time highs for the price of crude oil. And, you know, you look at some of the commodities, we've seen some of the food ones like cocoa and others go to all-time highs. And, of course, we've seen gold go to all-time highs. So, you know, the commodity board is waking up, and it's just a little bit now. The grains are still sloppy, but I think we're going to see the whole commodity board go up because the inputs, you know, farmers are going to need more for the grain if fuel prices go up and tractor prices go up. Ranchers are going to need more to, you know, for the cost of, you know, because as they raise cattle, input costs of grain will go up and all the things they need to produce will go up. Manpower, labor, etc. So I think that we're into a commodity cycle that's still in its very early stages, and we've seen a few breakout that kind of are giving us the feeling. Even copper had a run to $5. It's backed off because of China's slowdown, but it broke out to a new all-time high at $5 and backed off to $4. So I think that people should be looking. You know, I'm the energy bull and long-term, and we'll talk names, you know, and there's some great ideas out there, but investors that are listening should also be looking at those critical minerals and companies that are going to be able to bring them on, be it lithium, copper, nickel, uranium. All of those are going to be needed into the end of the decade, and there's shortages in all of them now. And so as we see the incremental demand come in, it's going to mean prices are going to elevate. So I think we're looking at the beginning of a commodity cycle. And so people should have exposure to all the areas of it. And my view is that if we want to get to a more environmentally friendly, you know, situation at the end of the decade, we're going to need to bring on a lot more copper and nickel, all those inputs. And of course, we're going to need a lot more energy, both oil and natural gas. I'm not in the camp that says that by 2035, we're going to be seeing peak oil. I don't believe that, because you look at the populations of India, China, South America, Africa. The OECD may see declines in demand because of the maturity there, you know, the emissions controls, more EVs. But just think about the amount of new capacity we need for electricity in the OECD, North America, Canada, because if we want to be able to have data centers, if we want to have more electricity for all the things like cars, you know, the EV cars, we're going to have to spend an enormous trillions of dollars to build out the infrastructure just for the electricity grid. And that alone is going to cause, you know, a lot of these raw materials that we've talked about to have big bounces as we go in the years ahead. So investors should look to the experts there. You guys are interviewing people all the time who have projects that are and financial capability on those areas. But I, from my side, I would say you and the biggest commodity market value is energy. Have a decent amount to energy, but also have a decent amount to the other areas.
Yeah, great points, Joseph. And I think the other areas, the critical minerals, still play into the energy theme, whether it's lithium or copper or uranium. They're still part of the energy complex along with oil and nat gas. So great comments there. I just wanted to ask you real quickly about two M&A deals we saw in the sector worth noting. Tourmaline Oil is acquiring Crew Energy, and Gran Tierra Energy is taking over i3 Energy. What do you think about the pickup of M&A in the energy space?
Well, in terms of Tourmaline, I think really believes in the LNG export potential on the West Coast of Canada. Plus, of course, there's going to be a lot more in the U.S. So they have already shipping gas to the LNG in the U.S. They are part of Rockies LNG. They're going to be shipping potentially to LNG Canada is going to make a decision this year for the phase two, train two. So there's a lot of upside, from this. And I think that that deal for Crew gives them a lot more reserves from on the BC side. So now they are the biggest. They were the biggest natural gas producer in Canada. Now they are the biggest Montney natural gas producer. And from the shareholders' point of view of Crew, you end up in what's considered the best management company in the energy space in Canada. You know, Mike Rose and his team did Berkeley, Duvernay. Now you've got Tourmaline, and you get a dividend. You're going to have a base dividend of $1.40, no dividend in Crew. And then you're also going to get special dividends, which they've paid regularly from excess cash flow. So I think that when you take it all into account, you're looking at a name you want to be involved in. And if you have Crew, if you bought it at $3, $4 or less, roll it in. And the dividend on that yield on your cost is going to be very generous. And the i3 deal, it's a counter-cyclical decision by Gary Guidry and his team at Gran Tierra. They were looking to get into MENA, Middle East, North Africa. But this deal was a deal where it got them you know, natural gas and some oil revenues in or production in Western Canada, about 19,000-20,000 BOEs a day. So they have, you know, let's say 30,000 BOEs a day in Colombia oil, 100%. Ecuador, they have, you know, potentially 5,000-6,000 BOEs a day because they've drilled new wells, and in the best well, I think, came in at over 2,100 barrels a day on, you know, on the IP, and some of them are producing, almost everyone, I think the ones that are over 30 day are producing over 1,000 barrels a day. And now you add, you know, 19,000-20,000 in Canada, of which I think 80% of that was natural gas. I think that's a contra investment approach. And I think it would, you know, expand the investment, you know, interest in Gran Tierra, because they will have a decent Canadian base on top of their South American base. And I think that would bring them a new shareholder group and potentially an expansion in the valuation of the company.
All right, Joseph, always interesting hearing your take on the energy sector. And hey, we're waiting for that pound the table buy opportunity, something that maybe we'll even see next month. We will follow up with you next month. Again, Joseph Schachter, founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report. Be sure to sign up for his report and also click the link in the show notes to learn more about his conference. Joseph's Catch the Energy Conference, again, happening October 19th in Calgary. Joseph, thank you very much for your time on this weekend show. Everyone, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend, and be sure to go back through our website, podcast, and YouTube page to listen to all of our daily editorials. Have a great weekend, everyone.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.